This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. 75 years ago, the federal government placed more than 100,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps. The relocation was a response to the attacks on Pearl Harbor. Parents were separated from their kids, and many people were forced to give up their property. Eric Muller has spent decades researching and publishing books about the subject. Now he has created a podcast to talk about the life that people lived in those camps and how those interned endured their treatment. The podcast is called Scapegoat Cities. Eric Muller is also a law professor at UNC Chapel Hill and joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's nice to be here.
Tell us more about the scope of the podcast series. What kinds of stories will you showcase?
So I have spent more than the last 20 years kind of rooting around in archives all over the country, but especially at the National Archives, for the books and articles that I've written. And when you do that, you come across these little gems of human stories, very human stories that have never seen the light of day, will never see the light of day. They're locked up in a cabinet somewhere. So these are stories that really try to illustrate the full range of what Japanese Americans experienced, from depression and isolation and deep unfairness to resilience and even joy and love. So they're very human stories. They are not technical legal stories. These are human stories about what individual real Japanese Americans experienced during this time.
I want to get to those stories in a minute, but I do want to take a step back and look at the legal picture. Tell us what's happening. These are American citizens.
Right. So these are, well, two-thirds, it was about 120,000 people. Two-thirds were American citizens because they were born here. The rest of them were immigrants, and they had all been in the United States for at least 20 years because after 1924, the government, federal government, shut down all immigration from Japan. So these were either U.S. citizens or sort of permanent resident aliens who were from Japan. And after Pearl Harbor, due to a variety of factors, including racism and hysteria and economic opportunism, they were removed from their homes on a moment's notice and locked up in camps for the better part of the next 3 years.
Tell us about these camps.
So there were 10 of the camps. They were run by a civilian agency called the War Relocation Authority, and they were spread all over desolate places from California as far east as two camps in Arkansas, actually. They were in remote, inaccessible places, and they were effectively prisons. They bore no significant resemblance to the death camps of Nazi Germany, but everybody called them concentration camps at the time, and that's because these were places where a whole people were concentrated because the government was effectively scapegoating them for the fears that the nation was feeling.
Was there a range of treatment? How were people treated generally?
So people were the government certainly provided for the basic necessities. They were given housing, and they were given mess halls in which they could take meals. The internees basically ran the camps because these were cities. That's why I call the podcast Scapegoat Cities. They were cities that needed, I mean, these camps were 9, 10, 12, 14, 18,000 people. The one in Wyoming, while it was in existence, was Heart Mountain's, was called Heart Mountain. It was Wyoming's third largest city. So they needed everything a city needs, and it was Japanese Americans who did that. So there was recreational opportunities and the full gamut of human life, schools, hospitals. And then, of course, there were also individuals who were singled out, locked up, segregated, placed in much tougher confinement because of suspicions about their loyalty. So there was really a range of treatment meted out to different people based on their circumstances.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories that you feature, because you say that there are so many personal stories that get lost in this kind of larger understanding of what was happening. One of the episodes features the story of an elderly man who's sent to a camp in southern Arizona with his son.
Yeah, his name was Otomatsu Wada. He had come to the United States around the turn of the century, like so many Japanese immigrants did, married twice in the United States and lost his wife, became widowed twice, but did end up having some sons. He was uprooted from his agricultural life in California and sent to this Gila River camp in southern Arizona. It's not terribly far from Tucson. He was there with his son, After a little while, his son was given the opportunity to leave camp for a period of time to go up to Montana and pick beets in the beet fields. So his son left, and that left this 60-plus-year-old man completely alone in the world. And so he kept telling people that he was going to leave camp and he was going to go meet his son, but he couldn't leave camp. His son was 1,200 miles away, and camp was a place you couldn't leave. So nobody really paid attention to him until one day when he disappeared. He went missing, and an enormous manhunt was launched for him, not because he was thought to be a security risk, but because the day that he left, it was 103 degrees.
It's in the middle of the desert,
right?
Yeah.
And so they were concerned for his safety, and he never turned up. So that podcast, well, he didn't turn up immediately, I'll put it that way. Mm. So that podcast just sort of helps us understand, you know, the loneliness and the what it might be like to be an older person who's worked and worked and built a life, and then on the basis of nothing other than your ancestry, having that taken from you.
And of course, no idea how long this is going to continue.
Of course.
You could spend the rest of your life there. As far as you knew, there's just no way to know. The other question it raises, too, is whether or not families were held together, to what extent they were broken apart.
Yeah, so there was actually a notorious event in the early part of 1943 in which the government, having first thrown everybody into camp because they were all suspected to be disloyal, turned around and decided that, in fact, they could figure out who was loyal and who wasn't. So they gave out this harebrained questionnaire, and families, individuals, had to answer that questionnaire, and it included questions about whether they were loyal to the United States or not. That, you can imagine, obviously drove wedges into families because these were different individuals. These were different human beings, and they had different reactions and different thoughts and different feelings. So there were circumstances in which, as a result of that loyalty interrogation, some individuals would be sent off to a separate camp and some would be left behind. One of the podcast stories actually brings to life that story of these loyalty questionnaires by focusing on a woman who gave answers that were, I don't know, I guess maybe we would call them sassy on the loyalty questionnaire, and got in some hot water as a consequence of that.
I mean, you would think that one would just answer them sort of with the greatest amount of loyalty you could, whatever you felt.
You would think, except if you've been kicked out of your home and you'd been sent to a desert camp for a year, you might have some other feelings.
Might have some other feelings, and they might be hard to keep to yourself. So
yes.
I understand that. You talked about Heart Mountain Camp in Wyoming, but this talks about a conflict between the internees and authorities regarding a fence around the camp.
Yeah, so when the internees got to Heart Mountain in Wyoming, there was a fence around the huge, vast perimeter of the campsite, but it was enormous. It was an enormous facility. The residential area was all confined to one area, kind of in the center of that big footprint. There was no fence around that when they got there. But the government announced all of a sudden in 42 that they were going to put a fence up, and it infuriated the people in the camp because they'd been playing by the rules, and now they were going to be locked up even tighter. Right around that time, there was a big snowstorm. And 32 boys, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, throw together makeshift sleds with wood that they find lying around. And they go up to a hill up at the edge of camp, and they decide they want to start sledding because they were from California. They'd never seen snow, right? So they start sledding, and all of a sudden, military police trucks roll up, and they're arrested because the place where they were sledding was right outside the place where this new fence was going to go up. So technically they were out of bounds. And I think the administration, they weren't so worried about these little kids on sleds, but I think they wanted to send a signal to the parents that there was going to be a fence there whether they liked it or not.
What about the relationship between the internees and the guards and the sort of the people who had to work at the camp? Because, you know, one of the things that happens is in scapegoating is that this massive other who are anonymous to you are demonized and become the recipient and the projection of all your fears. Once you get to know people, things change,
of
right?
Of course. I mean, and that's exactly right. The fear of Japanese Americans diminished as a function of how much contact people had with them. So actually, just to go back to the sledding story, this wasn't the first snowstorm. And the snowstorm before it, some of the guards climbed down out of the guard towers and took some runs on these sleds with the little boys, right? So, and the guard towers, after about 8-10 months, maybe a year, the guard towers were abandoned because they recognized that these people did not pose a risk. So, sure, I mean, you know, if you're a white person living in Los Angeles, You might have one set of views about Japanese Americans, but if you're working with them, living with them, eating maybe alongside them in certain circumstances, at least they did have their separate mess hall, but you're living alongside them, you come to realize that these are just ordinary people who are trying to get on with their lives.
Ordinary within a range, because, of course, even among ordinary people, there are extraordinary individuals. And you tell the story of one who was exceptionally popular at UCLA, and
yeah.
He carried his popularity.
So next Wednesday, when the podcast launches, there are two stories. One is the one of the old man who disappears, and the other one is this guy, Mo Yonemura, who at a time when Japanese Americans, like African Americans and other minority groups, were really marginalized in society, this young guy went to UCLA and he literally became the big man on campus. He was everything. He was everywhere. He was the president of the student body. He was the head cheerleader, tremendously popular. And then, of course, he's locked up and just before he graduates in his senior year. And he goes off to Heart Mountain continues to be amazing. He's holding talent shows and, you know, you name it. This guy did it. He was incredible. And then in 1943, he's given the opportunity to volunteer into the U.S. Army, and he does. And so the podcast talks not just about what a popular and amazing young man he was, but then what happens to him when he goes off to serve.
It's not good, but this is interesting, too, because here are people who we felt so threatened by that we had to lock them up, and now we're giving them the chance to serve. A unit that was created.
Right. That irony was lost on literally no one. Right? I mean, so this Mo Yonemura is going off to fight for freedom when his own family is locked up in a barrack behind barbed wire.
Now, there were others who went off to fight and did return, among them a man who would become Senator Daniel Inouye.
That's right. And actually, in the podcast about Mo Yonemura, it so happens that Mo Yonemura and Daniel Inouye were fighting in Italy in the same place the same day, and both of them became casualties in the same place on the same day. So, you know, it sort of leads you to wonder, you know, Mo Yonemura's life was cut short. Daniel Inouye went on to become the president pro temp of the U.S. Senate, third in line to the succession to the presidency.
And I would say a hero in Watergate who may have saved our republic and rescued freedom from
That's
the jaws.
Actually, one of my first political memories is watching Daniel Inouye question administration officials. So you ask yourself, gosh, what would Mo Yonemura have done?
Yeah, or others.
Or others like him, of course.
Well, what about stories of resilience as well? I mean, because that is part of it, is people are, you know, sort of recontextualized and having to make their lives in this. There have to be stories, too, of resilience and camaraderie that play out even afterward.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, there are stories that I tell about the contrary decision that some young men made not to serve in the Army, but instead to resist the draft. In order to protest the treatment that they had been doled out. And so there's a story of a young man who, notwithstanding the fact that he had just emerged from a sanitarium with tuberculosis and could have just failed his physical and avoided military service for that reason, decided just not to show up for his physical and was prosecuted for that reason. That is a kind of resilience that I think all of us might wonder whether we might have in a similar situation.
Now, you are telling these stories. We don't hear the voices of survivors or perhaps their descendants in this. Why did you make that choice?
Well, most of the stories that I have found are stories that one doesn't commonly hear a great deal of detail about. Certainly by now, any Japanese American who was in these camps at very most might have been in their early teens when this happened, and most of the survivors today were much, much younger. So there's a certain kind of community memory that gets passed down, stories about families being broken up in the mess halls, stories about the lack of privacy. There are obviously stories, valuable stories, that survivors continue to tell. But, you know, knowing how a particular person answered their loyalty questionnaire or knowing about this sledding incident, these are things that, you know, for the most part have been forgotten. And so what I'm viewing this, it's an opportunity to bring some new and somewhat more unusual stories out of those archival boxes and into the public discussion.
Well, tell us more about your sources. How did you find them?
Yeah, so a lot of them I found doing research for my books. You know, you go up to Washington, D.C. or College Park, Maryland to the archives, and they bring you these you know, these boxes, and those boxes are full of papers that nobody's touched for the last 75 years. And so you're looking through a lot of the stories I found are actually in the records of the lawyers who served at the camps. Because if you think about what lawyers might have been doing, they were advising the administration, but they were also trying to help out, right? They were running these loyalty interrogations. They were helping people figure out how to try to save their property back in California. So there's all kinds of incredible human stories lurking in those records. You can also look back at the camp newspapers, and you can find little stories, not the big headlines, but the little boxes on page 3, you know, that might really be very touching and revealing about something about the way in which a person was adapting or not adapting to these awful circumstances.
You can imagine getting official reports on the various episodes that you're reporting on, a lost, you know, someone who leaves the camp and the search and rescue effort. Is there much in the way of quotes, personal commentary that you're able to find?
There are, just to take as an example, there are, in the episode about the woman who's sassy on her loyalty questionnaire, I actually have her questionnaire and I have the transcript of her loyalty hearing. So when I read her words, I'm actually reading her words. I'm quoting her directly. She passed away 25 years ago, and so I couldn't get her voice, but I can try to bring her voice back into the discussion.
This is something that happened 75 years ago. What relevance does all of this have for us today, do you think?
Well, you know, part of my impetus for doing this, Frank, is obviously part is my love of this history, my belief that it is important in its own right. But, you know, since last November, certainly since January, there's a kind of ramped up conversation about how we might have potential enemies among us on the basis of factors like what country they're from or what their religion is. Talk about zoning people out, about surveilling people. So it certainly seems to me that if we want to make sure that something like the Japanese-American incarceration doesn't happen again, one way to help that happen is to understand more deeply what people actually had to endure when they were racially profiled. So I don't make any open political arguments in this. These are historical stories, but I think that certainly these stories are coming up against the backdrop of a renewed discussion about the kinds of circumstances that led to this tragic mistake 75 years ago.
Though the disturbing thing about it is the way in which people are quite willing to be marshaled into the sphere as they were. And so with all of the mea culpas that followed the internment, you know, here we are again. It does seem that we're easily, even with this record and with this memory of having
right.
made this terrible error,
right.
we seem to be easily pushed into this fear a second time.
Fear is a powerful emotion. But of course, fear, most of what we've been debating are policies, right? They're, you know, is it sensible to take people from Lebanon or Syria and say that they can't come in? And when you're talking about it as a mass of people, it's easy to forget that that mass of people are actually as many people as there are that many human lives, that many human stories, that many human relationships, that many parents and children and grandparents. And so part of what I'm trying to do here is at least indirectly to remind us that policies aren't policies. They are impactful things on human lives. And maybe if we think about that a little more and try to maybe put ourselves into the shoes of these people, we might think a little bit differently about the policies.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing us these stories and your podcast.
You're very welcome. So it's next Wednesday is
next
the big day.
Next Wednesday is the rollout. And how many episodes do you have?
They're going to be they're 9 episodes total. So there'll be two. There's one out already. There are two that are on the official launch date, and then there'll be 6 more.
Eric Muller, forthcoming podcast called Scapegoat Cities, features stories from the Japanese-American internment camps during World War II. Eric is also a law professor at UNC Chapel Hill. And the first episode's next Wednesday, and you can find out how to find those at our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Coming up, the bluegrass music, or is it chamber music? We'll find out when we hear Hank, Patty, and the Current live on the State of Things.